You're listening to Asheville FM at WSFM LP 103.3 Asheville. This is News Team correspondent Gary Leonard, and I am joined in the studio with Dr. Darren Waters, who is the Assistant Professor of History and the Special Assistant to the Chancellor at UNC Asheville. Darren, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Gary.
It's been a while since you and I've had a chance to talk, and I imagine we can talk about all the things. However, we are here today to speak specifically about the UNC Asheville's Department of History and the Vance Birthplace State Historic Site presenting a two-day symposium titled The Zebulon B. Vance Reconsidered, which is taking place on September 14th and 15th.
Right.
Do you mind speaking a little bit to that symposium for the listeners and kind of what that is going to entail?
You know, first thing I'll say, you know, Kimberly Floyd is not here with me, so I want to mention her name because Kimberly is the site director at the Vance Birthplace. And really, this was Kimberly's idea.
You just got roped into
it. Yes, and so UNC Asheville came along as a partner with this. And you know, ironically enough, we had no idea that we would be hosting this event with in the context of the current events.
Right.
So this planning for this particular symposium started over a year ago.
Right.
And Kimberly had come to Dr. Dan Pierce, who is the NEH, the National Endowment for the Humanities professor, professorship at UNC Asheville. And Kimberly talked with Dr. Pearson and said, well, this would be a good idea, you know, hopefully to have a larger conversation about Vance, talk about the birthplace, and hopefully it would generate more interest in the birthplace and bringing people there. So I think that they have accomplished what it was that they wanted to accomplish.
I saw that specific language in the press release that this has been in the works for a year.
It has.
Of course, with everything that has happened in the national spotlight regarding these monuments, like this is a pretty massive issue right now.
It is. And the reality is that some of the participants in the symposium, one person in particular, Dr. Gordon McKinney, who is the most recent biographer of Zebulon Vance. Biography of Gordon McKinney is a professor emeritus from Berea College in Kentucky, but he retired here to Asheville, so he lives here in Asheville. But he's also the editor of the Vance papers, and he is one of the most prominent voices there. But as he said in conversations that I've had with him, that this is an interesting time. This didn't just happen, you know, just fall out of the air, what we're seeing happening in the larger society. But this is something that has kind of been bubbling beneath the surface for a while, and we're just now seeing the result of that.
Well, we don't often have a historian in the studio, and I think, you know, I'd be remiss while I'm in this space with you to not maybe speak to the historical context and maybe not, you know, diving too deep into it because I think the symposium, a lot of these things will be unearthed.
Right.
But let's talk a little bit about Zebulon Vance and the Vance Monument that has been constructed in downtown Asheville as a symbol. What is the linear timeline of that? Maybe a little bit about Vance himself and why this historic site was constructed for him.
Right. Well, the Vance birthplace, and it's interesting with the Vance birthplace, Vance was only born there. He didn't live there for very long.
Right.
You know, they talk a lot about more about the backstory, about the experiences of people here in southern Appalachia at the birthplace. But as far as the Vance Monument is concerned, I think it was in the late 19th century, near the turn of the century, shortly after his death. But Zebulon Vance, you know, I encountered Zebulon Vance in my work when I was studying Asheville and Buncombe County and when writing my doctoral dissertation at Chapel Hill. And, you know, Vance was a longtime political figure in the state of North Carolina. And one of the things that I've argued about from my own position about Vance is that, you know, you'll hear historians say this stuff all the time, that history is very complex. We talk about the complexities of history, and it really is. Mm-hmm. I mean, human beings are complex, you know, in what we do and what we don't do. But Vance was an ambitious man. Dr. McKinney has made that quite clear. He was ambitious as a politician, you know, as an attorney before that. And so clearly, when you consider that, he was looking for political advantage when he could find political advantage. But the one thing about Vance, you know, he did represent the western part of the state, especially in state government, in a way that few others had up until that time. I know that Dr. McKinney talks a bit about people like Thomas Clingman, who was a prominent politician from this region of the state as well. And in fact, he and Vance were not friends with each other, kind of political enemies. But Vance is is revered in the western part of the state because, you know, when you consider the long-term history of North Carolina, especially before the Civil War, the western part of the state was really seen as the stepchild of the state.
Absolutely.
Nope, not much attention that this part of the state got. And Vance gave voice to that in a very different way. And I think, you know, when you look at his time as governor of a state as well during the Civil War, mm-hmm. it gets very complex there, Gary, because he was just as much, on many occasions, just as much a thorn in the side of Jefferson Davis and the Confederacy
wow.
as he was to the Union Army or the Union itself. So he sought whenever he could to protect the interest of especially lower class mm-hmm. white North Carolinians. At one point, with the stroke of a pen, he protected many of them from being drafted into the Confederate Army by making nearly 10,000 men in the state employees to keep them out of from fighting in the Confederate Army. So it's a very complex history that he has.
Indeed. I think, as you stated, history is always complex. But specifically with Vance and his role as governor and beforehand as a Confederate soldier, what I'm hearing a lot with a lot of these Confederate statues that have been rather controversial mm-hmm. recently is when they were erected,
right.
Because many of them weren't put up during reconciliation.
Right,
they were
right.
put up during Jim Crow
right.
in many ways as kind of this draconian, authoritative mm-hmm. white supremacist upholding these values and norms
right.
within the space. So timeline-wise, when was the Vance Monument erected?
Yeah, it was in the 1890s, at the very end of the 1890s, I believe. And dates are just really escaping me in my head right now. I'm just coming out of a constitutional history class, so things are kind of running up against each other. But It was erected shortly after Vance's death.
Mm-hmm.
It was given to the city of Asheville in part as a gift from George Pack. George Pack mm. was one of the biggest funders. George Pack came from the northern part of the country. So he was not a native of Asheville, but it was given as a gift in part to the city.
I see.
As a way of remembering Vance. But you are correct in talking about when so many of these monuments were put up. It's interesting about the Vance Monument, though. The Vance Monument can't really be characterized as a Confederate monument.
Right.
You know, it's so in that sense, it's a very different monument.
Absolutely.
I mean, there are other monuments in downtown Asheville that are specifically you can specifically identify them as Confederate monuments,
mm-hmm.
But the Vance Monument not, and that's the reason why I think it creates a very different narrative kind of around it.
Absolutely.
But there's a good article that your listeners would probably be very interested in, and I would highly recommend that they read this article. But it's by a woman. Her name is, she's a historian, Catherine Beicher, a very good friend of mine. She wrote an article years ago entitled Landmarks of Power.
Mm-hmm.
And she tells the story about when most of these
right.
Confederate monuments were constructed in the late 19th and early 20th century as a way, as you just implied, a way of telling a story. That a story are constructing a narrative that essentially privileged white supremacy.
Yeah.
And that's essentially what we see in so many areas.
So Darren, I've had the opportunity and really the pleasure of hearing you speak many a times in the community and getting to know you personally and just some of the insights that you have. And I know much of your work is very much seeped into historical analysis,
mm-hmm.
but I think given the climate that we are in, specifically as it pertains to these monuments, I do kind of maybe want to dip our toes a little
okay.
bit into the political landscape with that. So we have seen in New Orleans, we have seen in Durham, we have seen in Charlottesville and Baltimore, many of these Confederate statues that have been coming down in this like outcry from
mm-hmm.
the community to bring them down because what they do, again, represent these symbols of upholding white supremacy. I guess my question for you, and you can kind of tackle this however mm-hmm. you want to, is are we accomplishing the goal by removing these Confederate statues? And for me, I think there's maybe a missing piece in this, is that you can't just bring the statues down without painting a broader picture
right.
of institutions,
of the American. Mm-hmm.
structures, policies that are in place within white supremacist values and norms.
Right.
And this is something that is just distracting folks, focusing specific in Confederate statues and not focusing on these other facets that are, again, perpetuating these disparities and have done so over centuries.
Right.
That's my question.
Yeah, you're right. It has a tendency to become a distraction from the larger and more important issues. As a historian, I'm always interested in people engaging the past in a more sophisticated way, not just rudimentary knowledge of the past, but understanding that the narratives that we construct are is a political process in and of itself. You know, looking at what goes into curriculum, what we write into textbooks. There's been an effort to, you know, within the profession, the historical profession, to bring more voices to the table. Now we're kind of stuck with trying to figure out how do you, now that you've brought those voices to the table, how do you weave them together in a larger narrative? The one thing that I would like to say, too, about this that I think is being forgotten, when we think about America and the American experience, we have to always understand that America did not develop on land that was not occupied by other people, you know. So we're not hearing a lot about that.
This is stolen land.
Yeah, that it is. And that's just a simple fact. We don't like to talk about that. There are a number of scholars in it. One in particular, writer Robert Penn Warren, who talked about how we as Americans don't like to talk about the tragic moments in our past. We want a story. We want a tragedy that has a good end.
We want to rewrite the narrative.
We do. We do. So I think that we cannot overlook the fact that this was not an unoccupied land when it was settled. So there was another narrative that was getting displaced. So, you know, I feel the need to kind of make that point. But you are absolutely correct as we think about the larger narrative. I mean, you can go to places throughout the state of North Carolina, and I'm sure in other places in the South, and you don't necessarily see the stories of other people. I think about Harriet Jacobs. Harriet Jacobs is an example I could use here. Harriet Jacobs, you know, first African-American woman to write her memoir of her experiences in slavery. She had to live in a small attic for up to 7 years before she was able to escape North Carolina, to go north, to escape slavery. I mean, it's a story that so many people, when you mention this story to people, they haven't heard about it. I mean, we don't really teach it in the lower levels of education in secondary or high schools. We don't hear the story of people like Harriet Jacobs. But you go to Edenton, North Carolina, you see very little about Harriet Jacobs, but you do see the narrative of that is a narrative that privileges the white supremacist past. I believe that we have to make an effort if we're going to memorialize, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I think we need to be more thoughtful as a diverse society on what we choose to memorialize and how we do. But also at the same time, understanding that these ugly parts of our past are very real. And I think that you can't just sweep them under a rug. They have to be talked about. But do we celebrate those things? I mean, there's a difference between, I think, memorializing and celebrating it,
absolutely,
you know, and we have to think about that if that makes any sense.
Absolutely, and as you so eloquently kind of phrase the narrative specifically in, you know, U.S. history and the curriculum and what is included and who are the faces that we see and whose faces do we not see? Do you think we as a country and a society we run into the risk of just continuing to gaslight our history if this kind of next step of just the removal of Confederate statues without context begins to unfold?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that there's a way. This is, I think, an interesting time. One of my other favorite historians, who is Dr. Dan Pierce's mentor, who trained him at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, Dr. James Cobb. Dr. Cobb has made the point, and I agree with him, that when we look at these monuments today, they are historical artifacts. Now, I think that each community needs to have a conversation about what they want to do with those artifacts. If they want to move them to a museum, then they do. In in many ways, Gary, also I'll add here that these monuments and when they were constructed tell, in many cases, tell more of a story about the people who constructed the monuments than they do about the people the monuments were constructed to memorialize or to remember. Some of these people wouldn't even recognize themselves if they came back and they, you know, heard the narratives that we have created.
That's
but I think that there's a way for us to reimagine these spaces, and even with those monuments, in some cases with those monuments there. I mean, a brilliant artist could come up with a way to make you, force you as an observer to look at the Vance Monument in a different way, you know, to consider all of the context. I'm not an artist, so I don't, I'm not a visual artist, so I don't know how to do that. But I think here an example, a great example, in my opinion, was the bull on Wall Street in New York. If you remember, if you recall, not too long ago, the Raging Bull is there, but another artist put a little girl in front of it, standing defiantly in front of the Raging Bull, which made you look at it different, made you consider, okay, what does this represent?
Right.
And when we think about how women have been marginalized throughout our history as well, this it forces you to consider that. So is there a way that we could do the same thing with some of these monuments? I don't know.
That's fascinating.
I just throw the question out there.
No, that's an interesting take, because I think, you know, so many folks have just been so gung-ho on just like bringing them down and creating this like these empty spaces, you know, of like this is what was once here.
Right.
But is there a way to tell the story without erasing the history, but maybe challenging the way that you have been taught that history in a way. So I think that's a really interesting take.
It is.
So to kind of switch gears back to the symposium, can you speak a little bit, Darren, about the players who are going to be taking part of this? I know you mentioned some of the historians that are going to be present. Can you just give a brief snapshot of who's going to be speaking at this two-day symposium and what the listeners and folks who are attending this event can expect?
Right. Well, Thursday night, Dr. David Blight, who is, in my opinion, the foremost historian on the history of memory in the country, a professor at Yale University, he will be here to open the event. And what he does on that night will set up the rest of the conference. And if your listeners can come, it will be, I think, at 7 o'clock in Lipinski Hall at UNC Asheville. David has written a number of books. One of his best books, well, all of his books are just fantastic. I've had a chance to read all of these books. But one of his most important books is a book, Race and Reunion, which looks at the American Civil War in American memory. And David is not so concerned with why the Civil War happened. He is concerned in that book with how the Civil War was remembered, how it has been remembered over time. So he will be talking about the issue of memory, how we choose to remember the past.
Sure.
So he is Thursday night, Dr. David Blight. Then you will have a panel discussion on Thursday morning. I will be participating in that panel discussion. Dr. Richard Starnes, who is a dean at Western Carolina University, will be there as well. Dr. Stephen Nash, who has written a fantastic book recently on Reconstruction in this region, entitled Reconstruction's Ragged Edge. He will be participating. And also Dr. Gordon McKinney, the most recent biographer of Zebulon Vance, will be participating in that conversation as well. And then later that day, Sharon McCrum. I'm not familiar with her work, but she is a novelist, someone who is from this region as well, and she will be speaking that afternoon. So I think it should be a lively discussion.
Lively is certainly one way to put it, but again, I think so many folks are interested in this topic right now because I think people want to expand their knowledge of what they're seeing in the media because, as we know, the media can very, very much portray a very specific narrative. And this is a ticketed event, correct?
It is. It is. So you can go online, I think, to UNC Asheville and go to events, the events page, and you'll be able to register to get tickets for this event.
Well, Darren, sounds like a lot going on your end. Thank you so much for joining us. Do you have any closing thoughts regarding the event?
Thanks for having me, and I hope that many of you in the listening audience get a chance to come and attend this wonderful event and all the events that are happening at UNC Asheville, because there's always something going on out there that I think that can engage us and engage the community in a way intellectually that we need to be.
Engage our minds.
Yes, sir.
Well, thank you, Darren.
Thank you.